Welcome back to your morning conversation here on KXCV KRNW. I'm Jeremy Werner. And joining me once again this election cycle is Dr. Kim Casey, Associate Professor of Political Science at Northwest Missouri State University. We brought her on because, if I'm being quite honest, the last time we had her on, we had a little bit of a off-air discussion after our previous conversation, and I've figured I would bring Dr. Casey back on to give a little political perspective, historical and futuristic, on the midterm elections that we have coming up next week. Okay, so the first question I have is just kind of a historical perspective on the midterms. Is it true that historically in the midterms, the party that's in power in the executive branch generally loses seats in the legislative branch?
That is correct. And sometimes the losses have been quite dramatic. In the midterm of Bill Clinton's first term in office, so that would have been 1994, there were significant losses for the Democrats in that election.
Why is that? It seems in some ways counterintuitive, I guess, because you basically just had the American populace elect, you know, whether it be a Republican or Democrat, and then 2 years later they're like, let's see what the other side is like.
There's a couple of forces I think that are at play. One is what cycle, I guess, the president's term is undergoing. So typically what we see is a honeymoon first phase where they start out relatively high, typically because everyone's looking forward to the new administration, and then they begin to kind of slope downward towards the midterm elections. And usually a president's approval rating will pretty much bottom out about the same time as the midterm elections. And then it typically starts to pick up again. That's been the traditional cycle. The other thing you have at work is that the public tends to hold the president responsible for what Congress is doing. And that may be a little bit unjustified, since I think the framers' expectation was that Congress was going to be the dominant branch and that Congress was going to basically drive American politics. The public has a little bit different view of that. The public sees the executive as driving politics, and that certainly has become more so with the modern presidency since Franklin Roosevelt, where you have the modern presidents becoming more involved in domestic policy, and so the American public is picking up on that. So with that, then the American public starts out with high expectations of a president, and then as they begin to cycle through and they go through their cycle, the public is right there with them rather than paying attention to Congress and what Congress is doing. And so they look at Congress in some ways as a tool of the executive, as opposed to the executive perhaps needing to be more of a aid to Congress in terms of policymaking.
And I assume there are examples of that not being the case for midterms, where the party in the executive branch gains or maintains power in the legislative branch, whether it's Congress or House or both.
There have been, and you're going to catch me off guard here because I'm not up to date on that, but there have been cases that have been more dramatic than others of significant losses as opposed to a few losses. So it just kind of depends on the president, what's going on in the country at the time, are there economic issues, all of those things can play into how a president's party is viewed. I may be wrong about this, but as I recall, George H.W. Bush halfway through was in a pretty strong position. We were in the Gulf War and we were going through that, and so we hadn't hit where we were going to go with a recession. And so he was kind of on the upswing, and you wouldn't have guessed where he was in the middle of his cycle where he was going to end up, which was losing to Bill Clinton.
So looking at 2022, do you see history repeating itself again?
I think this has been maybe one of the hardest, if not the hardest, midterm elections to really call. There are many analysts of politics out there that think that the polling system is broken, and without the ability of polls to accurately predict, we're kind of as lost as anyone else, trying to figure out and in some cases guess what is going to happen. The conventional wisdom would suggest that because of Biden's approval ratings and where he is in terms of his presidency, that the Republicans would make significant gains. And, you know, that's anyone's guess as to whether or not that's going to happen. Certainly, I think it appears that they're going to take the House. And I think anyone that knows anything about politics is going to tell you right now that the Senate is kind of a throw your hands up in the air, nobody knows for sure. It's so close in the races that are competitive that it's almost impossible to call. And now we've got significant early voting in some of the states where the races are close. And so that can potentially become a factor. There was a debate between the two senatorial candidates in Pennsylvania, and the Democratic candidate didn't do as well as his people had hoped he would do, and so there's questions about his viability. He had a stroke a few months ago, and there's questions about whether or not he's up to the job, but then there are also questions about his opponent, who is a well-known celebrity, and whether or not he's up to the job. So early voting might actually end up being a factor there because of how they were perceived before the debate. So we'll see.
And why is it that it's clear that the House will switch to Republicans, whereas everyone's looking at the Senate and goes, I don't know?
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily assured. I think this is based upon the polling information that we're getting, where there's only a handful of House seats that are actually competitive. So they're looking at specific races and how those races are going to pan out. And that, of course, is assuming that there's no huge surprises somewhere else. There's ways to project who might be the winners versus losers just by what the makeup of a district is. So with that, then they put together who's likely to win and who's likely not to win. And it's still, I don't think the margins are going to be that great. I don't think there's going to be an overwhelming move towards the Republicans. As I remember, there's only a 5-seat difference between the Republicans and the Democrats in the House right now. So it doesn't take a lot right now to shift that balance. And we'll probably see a pretty narrow division between the two.
So going back to the polling, I would say probably a year ago, everyone was saying a red wave. And then the overturning of Roe v. Wade happened, and then it was like, oh, we have a blue wave happening, and now it's, you know, back to a toss-up. Why do you think the polling is so just like drastic like that? Is that because of all the events happening, or is that the way that polling changes in general?
Well, I mean, this is largely my take on it. There are a lot of these kind of pop-up polling institutions that have become popular, and it's become a big business to run these polls. So there's problems with the predictability of polls. There's problems with the sampling size. There's problems with, just having viable polls themselves. So that's one of the issues that we're having to contend with. So you're only as good as the data you get. And if you're not getting accurate data, then you're guessing. And so that's where a lot of people are. There's questions about that the right people aren't being polled, that people are withholding their answers. So there's all sorts of questions about polling itself. And then in terms of interpreting the polling data, if you don't have that accurate information, you kind of have to look to see what polls are more reliable, and if some of the old faithfuls are not correctly predicting winners and losers, then that can be a problem. So polling's just really kind of messed up right now. And there's been calls for attempts to try and reform some of how polls are being taken and what's being done. But because that's done by private industry, it makes it a little bit difficult. So really, who could drive major changes with that would probably be the big media, your networks that work with different polling institutions to come up with data. But I do think there's, particularly it's with who they are sampling, because you're getting these polls with really small sample sizes, and that can potentially affect how accurate your predictions are.
So I guess in these final few days, looking at the past year and how much everything kind of ebbed and flowed, is there something that everyone always says October surprise? And I don't know if that's necessarily happened yet, or maybe it has and it didn't have a splash like everybody thought, but is there something that could happen, whether it's national or globally, that could shift voters' opinions drastically?
Well,
not to ask you, hey, what's a doomsday scenario that could?
I don't know if there's anything that's going to shift things dramatically with the amount of time we have left. Obviously, a dramatic event could occur, and certainly there are some things going on with global politics that add to that concern. But in terms of how that's going to affect American voting, that's probably not the issue. The issue would be more the turnout, and then turnout then could possibly affect what the outcomes are in an election. But I think this particular election, the turnout is going to be a significant factor. Typically, when the turnout is larger, it tends to favor Democratic candidates. The information that's coming in from the early voting indicates a really heavy early voting amount of participation. So we'll just have to wait and see.
So one of the things I wanted to ask about was election integrity, because I feel like you can make the case that both sides are questioning it. Republicans, claiming that, there's questions about whether or not people are voting illegally. And on the Democratic side, you say that you see the questions over election integrity in terms of, laws that they say stop people from voting. And I feel like you can also say, okay, well, our elections are secure according to the Department of Justice and all these others. And you can look towards, like you said, early voting numbers and say, is voting really being restricted when we're having record turnout right now? So what does that do to the populace when they head to the poll and they're basically being told from both sides, hey, your vote may not matter because we have questions about the integrity of the election?
That's a hard question to answer. I think some of this stems from a disbelief that whether it's either position, that there's something wrong. And then it kind of depends on what you believe in terms of what is shown to be correct. So if you believe that there is voter suppression, let's say, and you find evidence of that, then that will probably support that view that yes, there is that. If there is no evidence of that, then Yes, that is a problem. And certainly some of the attempts to create more of a window for voting through early voting opportunities is providing more of a window. The problem is we exist in a federal system where every state has different voting laws. Every state has a little bit different voting practices. And so what is happening, I think, is with some of the questions about voter suppression, it's in specific states, in specific circumstances that you're having these kind of issues as opposed to a large national attempt at suppression of voting. So what may be legitimate in one state to complain about may not be occurring in the other. It may not even be possible to occur in another state simply because of what the practices of that state is in terms of voting. States have control of elections, and that's something I don't think you can say often enough. And so it matters at the state level what is happening with the elections.
So speaking of state level, Missouri, I would say, you know, growing up, I always heard bellwether state. I would assume that it's safe to say that's no longer true. But there is something unique happening this year, especially in our district where we're having a Democrat run for the first time in years. And according to the latest filings, her war chest is the biggest potentially we've ever seen in this district. You also have several issues popping up in Missouri that have kind of a liberal lean in terms of marijuana, Medicare expansion. So I guess the overall question is, even if Republicans do hold on to power in Missouri, is there a shift in how people are viewing the state government and maybe wondering if it's time to have a little bit of blue in the state?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a statewide movement towards that. I think certainly in this area, there has been a lot of activity by Democrats to become more viable in this region. And I think we're seeing some of the results of that transpiring. I don't know that it's, again, a necessarily a statewide issue with the voters that they want to see more mixing of partisanship within the state, or if it's simply candidate-driven, where you've got certain candidates in certain areas that are resonating with certain populations. And that's probably more likely than there being something statewide, because Missouri is so interestingly diverse. As somebody who is not from Missouri and observing it from kind of that perspective, of you have very different voting blocks in your two major cities as opposed to in the rest of rural Missouri, which tends to vote very similarly. So, you know, if you're looking at something that's typical, there are still bastions of voting blocks in Missouri and in Kansas City and St. Louis that are still leaning heavily to the left as opposed to the way the rest of the state has gone, which has been more right-leaning. So that may be part of it. Certainly issues about abortion, and Missouri is odd in that it has tended to vote somewhat towards the liberal side on certain issues as opposed to candidates too. So that's something that has kind of a long history. Passing medical marijuana, for instance, was one of those things. So that's an interesting factor that seems to be rather particular to Missouri.
And are we still seeing that divide between rural and urban, or to put it simply, city folk and country folk?
Yeah. I think in Missouri, to a great extent, there is some. I think the cities have actually decreased somewhat in power. There's been more of a move to suburbia. That's not anything that's necessarily new, but that continues, and our central urban areas continue to be depopulated. And so with that then comes more of that move towards the right, because suburbans tend to be a little bit more conservative than do urban dwellers, and so with that, then they join in with the rural voters, and so that's, it's really kind of that middle area between the urban and the rural voters that has moved, and they've moved towards the right.
Okay. So the final few things I kind of want to ask, you know, how, what you see happening in the future if A happens or B happens. A being Republicans regain control of the Senate and the House. What do you foresee happening in the U.S. if that were to happen?
Well, it depends on how much of a majority they have. If it is in the Senate, they can't block the filibuster. So Democrats are still going to have viability, and the Democrats still control the presidency. So then there's always the option of vetoing bills. And because if the differences are very narrow, in either or both houses, then overriding vetoes become difficult. So the burden would probably fall upon President Biden, if he doesn't want legislation passed, to become more adept at the use of the veto, which hasn't had to happen yet because he's been in control of both houses. So he hasn't had to veto legislation in any significant way. In terms of what it means for the House and the Senate, they're certainly going to try and pass things and put pressure on President Biden not to veto certain bills. And it depends on how much, if the Republicans had control of both houses, how much do they want to pass things in a bipartisan fashion? If they're trying to pass things in a partisan fashion, they're probably going to get stymied by the veto unless they can bring enough public opinion to bear on the president. So it becomes a classic game of political maneuvering.
Okay. And the other scenario, which I personally feel like is maybe the least likely, but let's say the Democrats keep the House but take the Senate. What do you expect then?
Probably a lot of wrangling in the House, and probably more of a drive for the Senate to leave on legislation and then trying to get enough support within the House. And again, it'll depend on how wide the division is and what the numbers are in terms of Democrats versus Republicans in the House with that kind of scenario. You know, if the Senate gets behind something, the Senate tends to be a little bit more media vocal, not always, but often. And so they may be able to bring some pressure to bear on the House. And if it's a matter of two or three votes different, then they might be able to swing things more their way. And again, because that party holds the presidency, they still would have an upper hand, I think.
Okay. I guess the final thing I have is, what do you foresee happening?
I think the Republicans are definitely going to take the House. I feel fairly comfortable in saying that. I think it's really close in the Senate. There are two races that are really popping out, the one in Pennsylvania and the one in Georgia. And those are both really close and difficult to call. The Democrat has been up in the polls in Pennsylvania. I still think he has a shot, even though he didn't do very well in the debate. In Georgia, the numbers have been trending, as I recall, towards Herschel Walker, who is another celebrity candidate. But Warnock, I believe, is still in the lead in that state. So. And Warnock is the incumbent, so he has that to his benefit. The thing about Georgia is that they have a runoff. So if neither candidate gets 50% of the vote, then it goes to a runoff. And that is the most likely scenario there. So it is quite likely that we could or would not know until January who has control of the Senate.
I did think of another question. I apologize. But is this a new phenomenon of celebrity candidates? And I ask that because I don't know what would be considered a celebrity in the 19th century or before the advent of Hollywood.
That's a question I would love to answer because that's related to what I did in my dissertation. There weren't celebrity candidates in terms of the Hollywood celebrity or the sports star, because we didn't have that. But we did have family politics, and we did have people that came from significant political families. And so that was more the norm in the 18th, 19th century. After the Civil War, you begin to see that recede, and then we get into the 20th century, and we have kind of the birth of media and sports in new ways. And so then we do get more of that idea of the celebrity. So that has become more of the norm, and the more we've developed that, the more that has become apparent. I think one of the drivers there is those tend to be people with money, and money has become increasingly important in politics.
So is this rise because we usually equate fame with intelligence?
I don't think so. I think we associate fame with name recognition, and we know, and I'm putting that in quotation marks, that person. They're familiar to us. And so if you've been used to watching somebody like Dr. Oz on TV with Oprah and on his own television show, then, you know, that's somebody you feel like you know, and so you feel maybe a little bit more comfortable with that person. Or that person is a Herschel Walker, where they've represented your state in sports and they have this big name, and so they bring out crowds, they bring out donors, and that's what really drives those celebrity candidates. And sometimes that works in their favor and sometimes it doesn't.
So future wise does this mean that the fame of, you know, fame and candidates being attached to each other, is that eventually going to go away, or is it just going to evolve into, I hate to put this out into existence, but maybe a TikTok politician or YouTube politician?
I mean, never say never. I think this has remained a relatively steady phenomena. If you go back into, and even you can go back earlier. I mean, there were war heroes, and war heroes came to the forefront because they had made a name for themselves and the newspaper had picked up their name, and that's something. So, you know, celebrity candidates are not necessarily, you know, all in every single race. It just so happens that the two celebrity candidates are in very high profile races that really matter to this control of the Senate. So they're getting a lot of attention. There's also the fact that both of the celebrity candidates have been endorsed by Donald Trump, and they've had that being brought in. So I'm not sure that it's necessarily something that we're moving to or it's going to increase. I think it's just one of those aspects of politics. And if you can get a candidate, if you are the party, and you can get a candidate that has good name recognition and can bring in donors and can do all of those things, that's all a plus for you if you're running that candidate. There was a film that came out in 1971 called The Candidate, and I sometimes show that to my classes, and it's about somebody whose father was a politician and they had a certain amount of celebrity because of that, and so the party put them up to be the candidate for the California Senate. And it was actually based upon a true story of John Tunney, whose father had been the heavyweight champion of the world, and his mother was related to the Carnegie family, so he had all of this background. And so they didn't expect him to win, but they ran him against George Murphy, another celebrity candidate who'd been an actor, and they fought it out, and Tunney actually ended up winning, but he was only a one-term senator.
So I know I said this three questions ago, but that's all the questions I have.
Okay.
Is there anything else you'd like to add or anything you'd like to mention?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, thank you once again for joining me. Once again, that was Dr. Kim Casey, Associate Professor of Political Science at Northwest Missouri State University. I'm Jeremy Werner, and this has been your morning conversation right here on KXCV KRNW.